It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. At the turn of the century, when the first generation of African Americans to be born outside of slavery was coming of age, the town of Buxton, Iowa became Iowa's first fully integrated town, and the community thrived. This hour, we'll talk about the unique history of Buxton with Rochelle Chase. She is author of Lost Buxton. She'll be speaking at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow evening at 7 p.m., and she is here with me now. Hello, Rochelle.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to start, actually, with a little bit of your history, because you've only been living in Iowa for a couple of years, and you're a writer, but you haven't written history before. You've written some romance and some other things. But what drew you to Buxton? How did you find out about this town?
Well, in 2008, my romance instructor, we became really good friends, writing instructor, that is, and she lived here in Iowa, and she says, you know, I've got this town, you've got to visit. And I thought, sure, I'm game. So when I came to visit her in 2008, she took me to the site, and I thought, wow, I can't believe in the middle of, you know, Iowa farmland, this town exists. And so each time I would come back and visit her, I'd go to the State Historical Society, and I would collect notes. I'd listen to the audio tapes of the interviews of the former residents. And I was just intrigued, and I had no idea what I was going to do with that. I was like, okay, I'm just collecting it. I don't have any idea. And then when I moved here a couple years ago, I said, you know, I think I want to turn that into a book. And I did.
And when you say visiting Buxton, Iowa, Buxton was in Monroe County, which is in sort of the south central part of Iowa, but it's a ghost town now. So when you went to Buxton, what did you see?
I didn't see much of anything. I saw the stone warehouse, which was crumbling, you know, just some walls and, you know, the framework for the roof. At that time, I think most of it was overgrown. Today, the Monroe County Historical Society keeps the lawn manicured. But then I think there were a lot of corn stalks and you know, weeds and such. And so I saw the stone warehouse, and then I saw the vault, the company vault, and that was pretty much it. So it was really imagining, like I said, that, wow, such a great town existed here. And for the time, I couldn't believe it.
Well, let's go back in time to 1900 when this town was founded. And it was a company town founded by Consolidation Coal Company.
Yeah.
And it was a town obviously founded totally on the basis of there being coal to mine in the area. As the town got started, though, it started in kind of a unique way with the company recruiting people of all races to come and work. And that was really unusual for the time, wasn't it?
It was. Well, I should say it wasn't the first time. In about 1880, Albia Mine had recruited African Americans to break a strike, mainly from Missouri. They were getting African Americans. Whitebreast was another mining company that had also recruited African Americans. But what was interesting about Whitebreast, they had built separate housing for the African-American miners to live in. I think Buxton and Muchikanock before it, they were the first to really do it on a larger scale. And obviously with Buxton, they were the first to bring, to integrate it, to integrate everyone. And like you said, they did also recruit other, you know, people from Sweden, you know, Slovaks, et cetera. And they would reach out to them as well. So I think they were the ones that did it most successfully and did it on the largest scale.
And when they recruited African Americans to come and work in the mines, I can imagine that at that time, companies that recruited African Americans saw them as an inexpensive workforce. But Consolidation Coal Company recruited them kind of on an equal basis with other workers. They didn't say, hey, you know, come work for us and we'll pay you half as much as we pay the white workers.
Exactly.
They recruited them and paid them the same.
Exactly. Which is really surprising, too, because when Buxton was founded, they did continue that process, at least in the early years, of continuing to recruit. And at that time, Buxton was unionized, so the black workers were definitely getting the same salary. So there was no incentive, really, for them to go and continue recruiting, but yet and still, they did. And don't really know why. You know, there's no real records from Consolidation to show, you know, why did they do this. Same thing with the Buxtons. Just don't know why.
Where were they recruiting workers from? Were their employees coming from down south, or just a little bit south.
No, it was mainly south. Virginia was one of the major states that they were recruiting from. And then also people, once they got here, they would write, you know, once they got here, they would write to their family members and you know, have them come up as well. So Virginia, Kentucky, just places like that, a little bit in Missouri.
So as the town grew, it was almost 50-50. Mm-hmm. African-American and settlers of European descent. A number of different ethnicities were represented from different countries back in Europe that kind of created their own little enclaves. But it was up to actually 55% mm-hmm. African-American at one point. Now, you mentioned that some of these other companies had created separate barracks or things like that, creating a segregated community as they recruited new workers. Now, Buxton didn't do that. So as the town grew, what did it look like as far as racial integration?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, to your point, they didn't do that. And they awarded, like, housing, for example. It was awarded on a first-come, first-served basis. As the people, you know, came, they were obviously paid, you know, equal wages, but they also had the opportunity to start businesses. You know, they didn't have to, you know, purchase things at the company store. They could start their own businesses. So there were quite a few African-American-owned businesses there in the town as well. And that was also with where the people settled also in the various areas of town. There were some segregated areas like Swedetown, East and West Swedetown. But it seems like that was more from, you know, probably the common language. Also that a lot of times the Swedes own their own property. So therefore, that was another difference with Buxton, is you did not have to live in company housing. So you could lease, you know, land in the, you know, areas surrounding the downtown area. And so you did have, like I said, a little bit of segregation there, but there were some African Americans in Swedetown as well. So the makeup was very diverse.
And of course, men working side by side in the mines is one thing, but then there were the women and the children living side by side in the community. And there were a number of schools in Buxton, but the schools were not segregated?
No, the schools were not segregated. There were three elementary schools, one in one of the Swede towns. And then there was the First Street School and the 13th Street School in the downtown Buxton proper area. And they were integrated. They had black and white teachers teaching black and white students. The ones in Swede town weren't as integrated, but there were some, you know, African-American students there. So they were. The company store as well had African-American clerks, men and women, working there. Had about 85 employees, and 18 of them were African-American. So, again, you had this really integrated integrated town. And I think what is so fascinating about it was just for the time, you know, that you had this not only right in the middle of Iowa and farmland, but that you had it in the country, given what was going on at that time.
Absolutely. And honestly, you know, there are so many communities today that are more segregated than Buxton was at that time, 117 years ago.
Yeah.
What about the churches in the community? And Buxton, we need to put this in perspective. Buxton was never a large town. What about 7,000 people?
You know, the population has been all over the map. I had been sticking to the 5,000 to 6,000 range because looking at, you know, some of the census records, looking at the number of people that came over from Muchikinock, looking at the number, they think they built maybe about 1,000 houses in the town, and some of the other research that I had uncovered, it seemed like 5,000 to 6,000 was more of the range in later publications. But yeah, it was not really a really large town, and yet you had all these amenities and you had all of this going on.
Well, and I think your book consists mostly of photos, and we'll spend more time talking about these really remarkable photos that you were able to share in Lost Buxton in a moment. But I remember reading in one of the captions of the photos that there were 8 churches in town. A lot of churches.
Yeah, you did
considering
ask about churches.
The the small size of the community.
Yeah.
When it came to worship, Was that also something that was integrated, or did people sort of retreat to their own enclaves?
No, churches were pretty much segregated. Most of the residents said that was the case. And one of them had a story to tell, you know, the two churches. There was a black church and a white church next to each other, and they used to, you know, sing the hymns back and forth. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what someone had said. So, but they were segregated. People said it was by choice. You know, if, obviously, if you wanted to go, you were not prevented, but people said that was pretty much by choice. But yes, at one time there were 8 African American churches. There was also a Slovak church and a Swede church as well.
Many, many churches for a small community.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the businesses that grew up in the town. There were also a number of organizations that were founded in the community. There was a YMCA, and in fact, there were 2 YMCAs in Buxton. And why were there 2?
Well, the YMCA was almost like the crowning jewel of Buxton. It was they spent a lot of money on that. And there was actually one that was for the men and one that was for the boys. So that's why there was 2, because boys couldn't go to the men's Y until they were 21. So, but the company had spent $20,000 in building this, which, again, it was like the largest industrial YMCA. And it had everything. On the first floor, you had pool, gymnasium, bathing rooms. They had parlors and a library and a reading room with leather chairs and a mahogany pianola. The second level had an auditorium where they could seat like 8 to 1,000 people, and they would have programs and people coming in from different places. The Catholic Church had services on the second floor. They had movies regularly there, and then they had lodge meetings up on the top. And then in the boys' Y, and the two were connected by a covered walkway, but in the boys' Y, they had swimming pool, which was heated, and then they had roller skating and dances up on the second floor. So they had a lot of entertainment that they provided in the Y, and consolidation was really very proactive in wanting to allow entertainment options for men, because they felt like, you know, keeping the men busy, keeping them entertained, and hopefully not drinking, and which there were, where that did go
and
on
gambling,
on the outskirts of Buxton. But the company wanted to, you know, offer these amenities to keep people productive and working.
We're talking about Buxton, Iowa, now a ghost town, but once a thriving community and the first fully integrated community in the state of Iowa. My guest is Rochelle Chase. She is the author of Lost Buxton, and she'll be speaking at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about history. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk about the State Historical Society's new effort to preserve more than 12 million pages of newspapers dating back to the 1830s. I'll be talking with State Archivist Tony Jan. Right now, my guest is Rochelle Chase. She is the author of Lost Buxton, and she'll be speaking at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Buxton was a little coal mine community in Monroe County, Iowa, in southern Iowa. It was also the first fully integrated community in the state of Iowa. Some people have called it a black utopia. And also, coincidentally, there will be a program coming up this weekend on Saturday in Valley Junction at the Valley Junction Activity Center about the history of Buxton, Iowa, with local historian author John Busby. Will be there to present stories about that. Rochelle, just before the break, we were talking about the YMCA, and I want to talk more about sort of the rich cultural community that developed in Buxton. I mean, this was a place with a lot to do, both at the YMCA, the two different YMCAs, but also the churches, of course. And then there were a couple of different thriving business districts as well. Tell me a little bit more.
The businesses, there were a lot of businesses were downtown. There were about 20 different independent businesses downtown. Anything from, there was a music store. There were several different grocery stores. There were, of course, as I mentioned before, there were bars and, I shouldn't say bars, more saloons and gambling establishments that were on the outskirts of Buxton. Buxton did not allow that in town. So it happened, you know, on the fringes. There was also, a a bakery. There were 15 miners that had gotten together and formed this bakery and laundry business. There were restaurants. There were hotels, at least two African-American-owned hotels there in Buxton, the bigger ones. There was just a lot also socially to do for men and women. There were lodges, the Masons, the Elks. There were literary organizations for women and men. The YMCA had a glee club. There were basketball, baseball. They had traveling, you know, performances come. And there was just a lot going on, not only for us, you know, a town that size, but also it would draw people from the surrounding communities into town. There was also a lot of commerce going on with people selling things, not only, you know, the people within Buxton, but farmers and such would come in from out on the outskirts of town and sell their goods. There just was a wealth of businesses in the area. And that was another thing that was a little bit unique in that most mining towns, they did not allow
private
businesses.
They just had the company store.
Exactly.
And that was it.
And you were required to buy from there. And that was another money-making source for the mining company.
Well, and Buxton did have a company store.
Yes.
And that company store seemed to have everything that anybody could possibly need with clothes and food and a bank and all of that. But they did allow these other businesses to grow up and clearly thrive in that community.
Exactly.
Outside of school, you know, we have this wealth of archived oral histories that were collected in the 1980s by some wonderful Iowa historians. And they, you know, have shared, and you share in your book, a number of quotes from those histories with people talking about what it was like to live in Buxton. So outside of school, did the children play with each other? Were there interracial friendships, or was this something that was limited to school?
The people interviewed were mixed on that. Some said no, outside of work and, you know, social, like public things like games and performances and movies. They said, no, we really didn't socialize. But then a surprising number did. Men would say they would drink and gamble together. One woman had stated, I think it was Dorothy Collier, had said no. Her mother had, you know, white friends, and they would come over and have quilting parties. It really just depended on the people that were, you know, that were interviewed. So there were mixed reviews on that.
And mining towns had a reputation for being kind of rough communities. Obviously, there would be a lot of men in one place, not necessarily a lot of families in some of these small communities. And Buxton had its share of trouble. Was there a major crime element?
Well, it depends on who you ask, meaning a lot of the people in Buxton felt like that reputation wasn't deserved. They felt like, yeah, it's like any other town. There are parts, you know, that you don't go into at night, like Coopertown, Sharp Inn, the places that had the gambling. You didn't go there at nighttime. But by the same token, they felt comfortably safe. Many people said they left their doors unlocked. There was no crime element for them. However, the people that didn't live in Buxton, those were the ones that seemed like that, you know, had said, you know, there were always these sensational headlines about murder in Buxton. And so they would definitely have the impression that, no, this is a rough and ready town, and no, you shouldn't go there. But the people that lived there did not feel that way. And
so there may have been stories being spread beyond Buxton that it really didn't have a reflection of reality.
Yeah.
And could have had a racial motivation.
Well, they did say there were murders in Buxton, but it was usually around gambling, drinking, domestic disputes, those kinds of things. No one interviewed, they all pretty much agreed they weren't racially motivated. That, yeah, you can get in a fight with somebody because of, you know, some other reason, but it wasn't because of race.
Listening to the oral histories, what kind of different perspective did you get from white residents and black residents of Buxton?
It was quite different. A lot of the black residents were very, I mean, you could just hear the passion in their voices when they talked about Buxton. Whereas for a lot of the white residents, it was a nice town. They had, you know, a good life there, but it was really more matter of fact. And that's also what I was listening to, you know, when I wanted to know, you know, did black people really consider this, you know, a utopia? You know, was it really that good, you know, as you hear about? And the residents that were interviewed seemed to feel that way. And they spoke very glowingly about it. And they also mentioned that when they left, it was a shock to them because some of them had been born there and this is what they were used to. And then to leave from there and experience the racism that they did when they left Buxton was very shocking for them.
Well, and if we, again, put this into historical perspective at the turn of the 20th century, I mean, racism was rampant. Segregation was the norm all over the country and, of course, especially in the South. When you were looking at pictures, and this is, as I mentioned, a wonderful collection of pictures from Buxton that just really transport you there in just a moment. Can you think of a couple that have really stood out for you that when you discovered this picture, it really told you more than you may have expected?
I think some of the pictures of the women in their, you know, well-dressed, in their, you know, finery, you know, it really spoke to the fact that it was a thriving town, that there were people that were very successful. Now, granted, not everybody was. Many people said money flowed in Buxton. There was no shortage. But that doesn't mean that everybody, you know, had money at the end of the day, right, or that everybody was wealthy. But the point is that there were both kind of classes, if you will, in Buxton. And Marjorie Brown was someone who talked about that you did have the society, you know, folks who went to all the, you know, the women's clubs and such. And then you had those that had 14 kids and were really, you know, really working just to support their family. So I think the pictures of the women, you know, that were part of this Buxton society, that was very fascinating to me. I think also because mining is so different for me, I'm not from here, and so I really had no exposure to that. When I was looking at some of the actual pictures of the miners, you know, down working, I mean, that was really amazing to me too, because I couldn't imagine what it would be like, you know, to work in a mine. So
and
those
it was
were
very dangerous.
Oh my gosh,
work.
Very dangerous. So that was fascinating, as well as some of the miners' take on that. I didn't realize that also that some of those jobs were considered glamorous by women, you know. So the mule driver, for example, that particular role, you know, some of the men had said, well, yeah, I loved being a mule driver. The women loved me. You know what I mean? So it was, okay, those are my words, not theirs. But still, that was pretty interesting, too.
I'm talking with Rochelle Chase. She is the author of Lost Buxton. And I know the history of Buxton is something that a lot of people in Iowa have taken a lot of interest in. If you'd like to join our conversation with your favorite Buxton story or with a question for Rochelle, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And part of the uniqueness of this community, of course, children growing up in this community, young people being a part of the community, they had an opportunity for education that many African-American young people just didn't have at that time. And you did some research about some of the really remarkable people who came out of Buxton, the first African-American man to graduate with a medical degree from the University of Iowa, for example. Can you tell me a little bit more about some of the people who really made history?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was Dr. E.A. Carter, the one that you mentioned there, and he became a company doctor there in Buxton, one of three. And again, he would have both black and white patients, so he wasn't just, you know, seeing black patients. There was also Hope Armstrong. He was someone that pretty much every resident that was interviewed almost knew of. And he was one of the recruiters that had been, you know, had gone down and recruited African Americans from the South to come work in the mines. But he had really close ties to the company. And so he had the only meat market or the only business there in town that was allowed to use the company's check system. So very, very close ties. And what that means is that they could buy on credit. He also was one of the wealthiest African Americans in southern Iowa. He owned about 1,600 or more acres, 17, 18 farms that he would rent out to people. He had a slaughterhouse. He would buy livestock from farmers in the area. He raced thoroughbreds, was very well known throughout Iowa for his thoroughbred racing. So he was one that was very well known there. George Woodson was also another prominent African-American in town. He was an attorney, And he had also co-founded the Niagara Movement, which became the NAACP, the Iowa Negro Bar, the National Bar Association. So he was very, very much involved there. Also had been active in the Republican Party, ran for a few offices, didn't win. But another one, very well known and very respected by the people in Buxton for being a great speaker and really just motivating people to better themselves.
Now, as I mentioned, Buxton is no longer. Buxton is a ghost town. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, all good things come to an end, I guess, which is interesting because when they built Buxton, it almost seemed like they weren't expecting that. You know, they had built the town with this level of permanence kind of in mind in the buildings. But in 1914, the demand for coal had started to decline. And so Buxton had experienced some layoffs. And that was also kind of new for Buxton, since the coal was being supplied to the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. They pretty much had, you know, pretty much nonstop work. But in 1914...
And that was rare in a coal town because the demand for coal usually just declined in the summer if it was something that people were using in their homes.
Right.
So they had a client who needed coal year-round,
exactly,
which was one of the reasons that Buxton was so...
Exactly. But they had, like I said, in 1914, that they had the problems with the demand. And then also the mines were pretty much played out in and around Buxton, so they had opened up, started moving operations to Console and Haydock, opened two mines there. But things just, by about 1922, they pretty much had, everybody was pretty much out of Buxton, and they were working in, they'd moved to these other camps that were owned by Console or by Consolidation. But pretty much by 1927, those had pretty much ended as well, and they were no more.
We have a question from a listener. Were there any African-American elected officials in Buxton, Iowa? Now, it was a company town, so I don't even know if they had local government.
No.
The company was kind of in charge, right?
The company was in charge. They did have, like, African-American constables in town, but there weren't really any elected officials except for in the union. They did have some African-Americans that were union leaders. They did at one time have this organization that they called the Colony, which was kind of this informal, one of its roles was an informal kind of keeping people in check, like if people were being too loud or, you know, someone was being disruptive, you know, they would impose fines on them. And they also, so they had elected officials for that particular organization, but it was, there was no formal positions since it was not incorporated.
So when the mine ran out, when demand for coal lessened, and this was normal for a coal mining town to just kind of die.
Yeah.
But where did the people go? You know, I mean, Iowa, as we know, there are some moments of progressive history in Iowa when it comes to race, but also it's been a fairly homogenous state, especially during that time. Did the African Americans who lived in Buxton, did they just leave the state?
Well, it's really been a little bit difficult to track down, you know, where the most of people went. It seemed like people just kind of scattered. Some left the state. Dr. E.A. Carter ended up going to Detroit. Some people went to Chicago. Some people, like Hope Armstrong, had kind of stayed in that area because he owned land. People went to Des Moines, Waukee. They went to other mines. The common thread, though, wherever they went, you know, in Iowa was, you know, here they were doing things in Buxton, and then when they went elsewhere, it was going back in time. I know one person who was a school teacher in Buxton had mentioned that when she left Buxton, she couldn't get a job. You know, she worked as a cleaner, you know, doing domestic work. So it really, people scattered all over, but there wasn't like one place that they went to.
What do you think the legacy is of this community? I mean, it's a fascinating story. It obviously captivated you, your imagination and your heart. But what do you think the legacy of Buxton is?
I think the legacy is just the principles of inclusion and equality, you know, and the difference that that makes for the success of a town, and also in terms of people getting along and being able to really focus on their own lives, you know, and their own, goals. And I think also showing that that is possible because it comes from leadership, that it comes from, you know, consolidation, setting the tone for this is the way this town is going to be. And I think it was a very effective example of that. So I think that is a big legacy for the town, what you can learn from it, why it was successful.
Rochelle, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It's been great being here.
Rochelle Chase is the author of Lost Buxton. It's part of the Images of America series and features so many really wonderful photos from Buxton, Iowa, back in the day. She'll be reading and speaking at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. Coming up in just a moment, another effort to preserve history. I'll talk with Tony Jan, who's the state archivist with the State Historical Society of Iowa, which has just unveiled its plan to preserve more than 12 million pages of newspapers dating back to the 1830s in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The State Historical Society of Iowa has unveiled its plan to preserve more than 12 million pages of newspapers dating back to the 1830s in Iowa. I know that this is a story that many people have followed closely, and State Archivist Tony Jan is here with me to talk about how this process is going to work. He'll also answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Tony, hello.
Hi, good morning, Charity.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. And let's talk about the plan. Obviously, this giant archive of newspapers is an incredible treasure for the state of Iowa. A lot of people have been very concerned about what's going to happen to this treasure. So what is the plan to preserve these papers?
Well, our collections, we actually throughout, we have titles representing all of Iowa going back to 1837. Actually, there's over 650 different papers throughout time and all, and over the years we've collected them in newspaper form on the newsprint, and over the years we've done, which is the industry standard, which is to preserve them by taking the content on those newspaper pages and converting it into microfilm. And then either allowing for the microfilm to be available so people can come into our facilities in Iowa City or in Des Moines to look at those microfilm reels. And in more recent times, we've done digitization. We make them accessible to researchers that way. And so what this plan is in our collection, we have approximately overall about 24 million pages to date that have been preserved in some way or another. There's an additional 12 million pages that still need preservation attention. And so this project is focusing on addressing those approximately 12 million pages and taking and microfilming them from the newspaper, which is very fragile. It's very delicate. It's not been, as many people know from their homes, when they get the paper, if they leave it out on a shelf or they just leave it in the house, it yellows, it ages, it gets brittle, it crumbles. We've done many steps to make sure that doesn't happen with our newspapers, but they were, these papers were never designed to last, at least the more current ones. And so this plan will allow us to focus with our partner, Advantage Companies out of Cedar Rapids, and they're going to take those pages, they're going to preserve them by microfilming them onto microfilm, and then working with local publishers and local communities to get those pages where we can, get them digitized and make them available on the web, or we'll have copies of the microfilm made, and they'll be available for people to research in our two research centers in Iowa City and Des Moines. So this is very exciting.
And you mentioned working with publishers. So the publishers of these newspapers still hold the copyright to this information?
Exactly, Charity. So the way the copyright law is currently structured, any paper, newspaper, that was published from 1923 or before, those are considered fair use. And so we have a lot of flexibility in how we can make those available. Any paper that was published from 1924 to present, the newspaper publishers own the copyrights to those newspaper pages, the content on those newspaper pages. And so part of this plan is for Advantage to work in partnership with the local newspaper publishers, as well as the Iowa Newspaper Association. Also, they've been kept abreast of the progress of this plan, and to ultimately making sure we're securing those copyrights so we're respecting the publisher rights.
The newspapers, you said they're going to be preserved with microfilm. In addition to digitization, microfilm, if anybody's spent any time with this, it feels like pretty old technology. Is that still considered to be state of the art?
You know, it's an oldie but a goodie. The thing we can assure with microfilm, it's been a well-worn standard, it's been proven, and we can assure that when it's been put on the microfilm, as long as we keep that master, the master microfilm, if we keep it in a refrigerated environment, a little bit cooler, with clear temperature and humidity controls, and if the quality of the microfilm is good, it can last for hundreds of years, and we get a good, clean, crisp image. That is, for some, the world is beginning to move to digitization as a standard, but in the case of these newspapers, we have just made the decision that microfilming will be the preservation standard going forward.
Now, in reading the press release, obviously everybody knows that the budget are tight on the state level right now and with the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. Advantage, this company in Cedar Rapids, has agreed to take on this project at no cost to the state. Can you explain that relationship? I mean, what is the benefit for Advantage in this?
Well, that's a really great question. Thank you for asking that. Advantage and the State Historical Society have had a partnership, government contract partnership now, doing microfilming services since 2011. And they've demonstrated great professionalism. They're experts in their field. And they're a real benefit to the work that we do here at the Historical Society. And so a couple years ago, we began to look and began to ask the question, how are we going to move this forward? What's going to be the best way forward? We began to look around, and in Advantage, clearly they expressed interest because they share our passion for newspapers, the content, and making them accessible to people. And so we began to develop kind of very, very slow, but then accelerating over time, kind of the discussions of kind of what would that partnership look like? What would that public-private partnership be? And what would it encompass? And what resulted is this particular plan. The benefits to them, obviously, they're a for-profit organization, so they're benefiting in that way where they'll be doing performing the work. The work will be funded by existing funding sources that are available right now, which include some state-level grant funding that currently local libraries acquire to do preservation filming, as well as getting their content accessible. Also, longer-term, Advantage is working on developing longer-term funding sources, as well as they're working on developing a online search portal where the digitized images will be placed, and people will be able to get access to those. Now, I don't know all the details, haven't been worked out yet. They're not planning on launching that, I believe, until next, 2018, next year. But they'll probably, from the conversations I've had with Advantage, the direction they're going towards, where at the State Historical Society will provide free access to that, to those digitized images. And if people want the convenience of doing the researching in their home, that is something that will probably be there'll be a pay element involved. But I don't have those particulars yet. Those are still being decided.
All right. So theoretically, if somebody wanted to do this research and go visit the State Historical Society in Des Moines or Iowa City, then they could have free access to.
Exactly.
All right. And right now, how are people accessing this newspaper archive? Is it even possible?
Sure it is. They can come to our research centers, and then they can access all the microfilm we do currently have, the work that's already been preserved, And if people were to come to us and say, I would love to see an issue or a run of papers that that have not been preserved yet, depending on the condition of those papers, we do what they did 100 years ago. We go and we pull the actual volume and we give them an opportunity to look through that. It's becoming more difficult to do that today, though, because of the advanced age of some of these newsprint pages. In many respects, we may not even be able to open them up one or two more times because they're so fragile and they're so brittle that if we turn the page, they'll crumble.
Once these newspapers are photographed or microfilm and digitized, then what happens to the hard copies?
So that's it's going to be some different ways we're going to approach that. Really, our focus is preserving the paper and the content on the paper. In some cases, with some of the collections we have, they're so rare and they're so unique that we treat them as historic objects, just not for the historic content that are on those pages. In those cases, our collections committee, who governs how we work with our collections, we will get them to basically sign off on making sure that paper remains within the Historical Society collections, and we'll spend the limited state dollars that we have to preserve those and make sure that we're treating them as kind of one-of-a-kind objects. In other cases, if we make the decision that some of the newspapers may be a little more common, they may exist elsewhere in the state, we'll work with our partners throughout the state to find other places or other homes for those. Since we've already done our assigned task, which is to preserve that content for posterity. And in some cases, if the pages are already out there in the community, they're widely accessible, they've been preserved, then we make a decision that we may not want to retain those pages at all, and we may make the decision to move those on.
As you're moving forward with this process, again, I know that this has been something that people have been talking about and worrying about and coming up with solutions for many years. Do you have concerns? Are there things that you're worried about moving forward?
In terms of the partnership or in terms of just the overall desire for people to have newspapers preserved?
Both.
Well, I think it's just, I think the thing I think people take faith in that, the State Historical Society, and then there's been a lot said, there's been a lot written on newspaper, the new state of newspapers in Iowa. The one thing that has been ironclad and steadfast through this whole process is we are really passionate and we really consider about that newspapers are the first cut of history. It's in many respects, it may be the only thing written about a topic. It may be the first time that somebody writes on a topic. It's kind of that starting point for a lot of people in their research, whether they're looking at something very, very detailed story in Iowa history, or just they want to understand, get the obituary from a beloved family member who passed away. It just represents every Iowa community. And so what's really wonderful about this is it gives us an opportunity to take that forward and be able to put more time, attention, have more resources dedicated into this so we can get these pages preserved and do it in a way that we're following existing national standards, and people will be able to, no matter if it's today or 50 years from now or deeper into the future, they're going to be able to find what they need. And so our staff and our professionals that we're working with Advantage are very committed to this partnership that we're going to have over the next 5 years. And over the next couple months, we're actually finalizing all the operational kind of things that we're going to be doing on a monthly and a yearly basis. And that will define the partnership, and it's just a question of just everybody knowing what's the end goal in mind, and we're going to focus on making sure we're delivering that because ultimately we need to get these pages preserved, and that's what's the single driving focus over everything. And then once they're preserved, let's get more of this accessible so people can actually use it, because I'm part of that group that believes that if things are not accessible, they're hidden. And if they're hidden, people don't know about them. It may not matter in their lives, or it may not be something that's relevant today. So whether you're looking for a a wedding notice, or if you're looking for an important article about a particular community, we want to make sure that information is accessible for all of Iowans. And newspapers are the great way to get that information out there and get it started for folks and their research.
Now, it's one thing to digitize all of these newspapers. It's another thing entirely to make them searchable, which I know for a lot of people is a very exciting prospect that maybe they could punch in the name of someone that they, you know, in their history, and articles would just pop up about them. Is that part of this process? Will this archive be searchable?
That is the goal. Again, if it's, I always like to think of searchability is a fairly straightforward thing, but I think really for me it's about findability. I want to make sure, and Advantage shares this, we want to make sure that this content is findable. So one of the projects that we've been working on, which is separate from this, is a separate partnership with the Library of Congress. We received a National Endowment of Humanities grant over the last number of years to digitize currently over 200,000 pages, and we're in the process of doing getting ready to do another 88,000 separate from this initiative. But one of the things that happened as part of this project is we got some really wonderful experience, our staff did, as well as Advantage for that matter, on how to not only how to do digitization, but how to do it in a way where you can get really strong findability on newspaper words that are on the page, and searchability, as well as the build and the construction of a website. Also, we've learned from other states, as well as other partners that we have in the private sector, to how you do this well and how you do it effectively. People can trust that this isn't the first, we are not the first organization. We're not at the quote-unquote tip of the spear where we're trying to kind of lead the way in doing this for the first time. Other organizations have had lots of different experiences and have done some things well and some things not so well. So we have the opportunity to learn from all those other mistakes that have been made. So ultimately what we come up with when we launch next year will allow us to allow for the greatest possible findability that we can do within the standards that we know that are out there today.
So when you look into the future, is there something that you are most excited about having this kind of access to? Is there a pet project in your history that you're hoping to find out more about?
You know, I think for me, it's about connection. I'm the state archivist, and archivists or the state archivist is my at a very high level. My responsibility is to document government, it's to promote history, and it's to secure rights for people. I'm just a really big fan of newspapers. Are a vehicle to help us achieve those ends, but really, where the power of newspapers really lives in is if I can take newspapers and information that's in those newspapers, and if I can begin to connect it to some of the other types of materials that are out there in the world, if I can connect it to state government records, if I can connect it to personal papers that have been donated by from Iowans over the years, to books that we have in the collection. Now, obviously, we're not going to have a single portal in the near term that's going to be able to do that. But this kind of will help us over time realize that if we can tackle and we can successfully, and we're confident we will be able to do successfully, get more of Iowa's newspaper history out there and get as much of it as we can that's accessible, that creates an incredibly powerful tool and vehicle that not only myself but other historians can use then and combine it with other sources of information that are out there and start connecting dots and drawing conclusions to things that they never would have assumed before. That's what's most exciting for me as a state archivist and kind of a potential benefit to everybody by making these accessible.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
State Archivist Tony Jan, we've been talking about preserving newspapers.